begin what we finished up 8 of them here. And that leaves us the very end of Perek Gimel. It leaves us in Pasuk 31, Lamed Aleph. It leaves us a one-liner for a Shoftim, which is very surprising in these times, because all the Shoftim up until Gidon get a reasonably large amount of press, and Shamgar Benanat does not. So let's take a read at it. It's in 331. Vaharav, and after him, assumingly after him means after Avin Gera, Haya Shamgar Benanat, was Gera by the name of Shamgar Benanat, Vayachat HaPlishtim, and he struck, fought against the Plishtim, Shesh Meot Ish, he conquered 600, he killed 600 people, then Malmad HaBakar, a Malmad HaBakar is probably yoke of a goad. I don't know. Well, let's take a look. I'd be surprised. I think Malmad may be the blade that's on the Hudarvan, Mardea. Yeah, the Darvan and the Mardea, if I'm not mistaken, is not a goad for the cow. It is the yoke of the cow comes down, and then in front of the yoke of the cow is a blade which is used to plow the ground. If you can envision this, I know we're far removed from that type of something like that, but it's a single blade, tends to be dull, and its goal is to cut through the ground and create ditches on which you would seed at a later time. If I'm not mistaken, that's what a Darban and a Mardea are. So essentially, he took this blade from his cow, and he knocked off 600 Plishtim, Vayosha Gamhu at Yisrael, and he saved Israel. The next pasuk immediately. So who was this guy, Shamgar Ben Anat? Before I discuss who he was, and I mentioned this before, but I'd like to repeat it, the first pasuk in chapter 4, which is the Devorah Parsha, says, Vayasipu b'nei Yisrael asotara b'nei Adonai, v'ehud meit. B'nei Yisrael continued to do bad in the eyes of, or they started again to do bad in the eyes of God, and Ehud is dead, which means Shamgar Ben Anat disappeared. The easiest way to understand is that Shamgar Ben Anat probably was during the last few years of Ehud's time, and therefore they ruled in parallel. But if Ehud was such a powerful ruler, why would he have another guy ruling next to him? So the Radak says a little bit differently. He says, the Radak says on Ehud Mei, by the way, Radak is where David Kinkley, who lived, if I'm not mistaken, about 1350 to 1450 or so, if I'm not mistaken, France. He was a linguist par excellence. What most people don't know is that he actually commented on all of the Torah as well. All of the Torah. Very rarely, you know, when you're growing up, you don't really have the Chumash which has the Radak in it. But he is actually a Perush on the Torah, of which most of it was lost except for half of Sefer Bereishit. So if I take a look at the Torah Chayim, you will have the Radak there, and it's a beautiful Perush. Because he does what Rashi claimed that he wanted to do, which is to be very pshat or text-oriented. But Rashi essentially says, Rashi starts off, Sefer Bereishit said, I'm coming here not to make up anything, but I'm here to tell you Pshitosho Mikra. But Rashi, of course, is famous for bringing down Medrash after Medrash. So there have been books, entire books written about what was his real goal. Does he believe the Medrash is really pshat? Did he somewhere down the road decide when he rewrote it that it would be more valuable to give people the Medrash, even though he started off with pshat? The Radak is pshat-oriented, always. He does bring down Midrash, but he tries to work them into pshat. Very modern type of commentary. And he's really terrific. So that's Rav David Kimkley. Rav David Kimkley. I don't know his father's name, so he called him Radak. Rav David Kimkley. So he says it like this, Ve'ehud meit, Lama zachar mitat Ehud? Why does it tell us about Ehud's death? Haya logos kor mitat Shamgar? Why didn't it say that Shamgar had died? Shofet acharav, because the pasuk specifically says that Shamgar was the shofet after Ehud. So you can't, it's hard to actually say that Shamgar was parallel to Ehud at the end of his life. Elon Mira, he says, it seems to me, ki bimei Shamgar lo noshu Yisrael tshua shlema. He did rule after Ehud, but even then it says, Vayosha gamhu et Yisrael, it wasn't a real good tshua. It wasn't all that wonderful of a salvation. Let me continue on. Velo atzram ilasot harab enei Adonai. And they did not stop from doing, during his times, people continued doing essentially lo dizar, or whatever bad they did. Velo shakta ha'aretz biyamat. And therefore, during his days, The land was no longer quiet, which means they did not peace and quiet for an enemy. Halo tireh. You could tell this, he says, Kilo Amar Ella Vayosha Gamhu et Israel, because it says, and he also saved Israel. Now that's very important. The Radak points us to exactly the right place, and therefore I'd like to take you to that location. Please flip ahead to chapter 5, to Devorah Shir. And there's some beautiful stuff which I think today is much more meaningful than it ever was, but it has been for a long time. If you take a look at Pasuk Vav, it says, we're in 5, 6, chapter 5, 6, in the middle of the Shir, the retelling of the story. B'nei Shamgara ben Anat, B'nei Yael. So what's interesting is he actually sort of equates Shamgar with Yael, which would, since Yael was contemporary of Devorah, it actually sounds like Shamgar is a contemporary of Devorah. Chadlu orachot. By the way, just for curiosity's sake, I know I'm not giving a grammar course, but it's kind of curious. Whenever you see a kamatz chataf, do you see under the word orachot? That's called a kamatz chataf. It has a kamatz with what looks like a shva next to it. It's always pronounced o, as opposed to a. Even us Sfaradim who speak Sfaradim Israeli always pronounce that as o, like we were speaking Ashkenazis. That's always pronounced as oh. Whether you're Ashkenazi, Sephard, it doesn't make a difference what community, which is why we say Tzahorayim and not Tzaharayim. And so just for curiosity's sake, if you see that, it's an O sound, not an A sound. It's something that most people don't know. You pondering something? Or?
Yeah, because you're saying an O sound, and when I say that it's aw, which is a different sound than you're saying.
That it would be aw.
You're saying like a above with a dot over it.
Oh, well, and
sort of you're saying.
Right, and in Israel, you probably don't hear really the difference between O and O. I don't think there are. There really is no O sound. It's only an
well,
O sound.
Well, that's because, well, that's the
Ashkenazic
word. Or A-E.
So you would pronounce this the same way you would pronounce the word call, which also has a
pronunciation. Well, I know. Call is always. Yeah.
So this would be Orachot then. Or Orachot, whichever way you come with. But it's not Arachot, actually. Uh-huh. Even if you're Sephardi, it's not Arachot. But anyway, we're getting back to the actual topic. B'nei Shamgar ben Anat, B'nei Yael, Chadlu Orachot, which means the roads became bare. Chadlu, from the word to stop, the roads became stopped. Now, in the song, somebody reading this a while ago may not know what it means, but today we know exactly what this means. I think we can guess what this means. Chadlu Orachot.
It was dangerous to go on the road.
Too dangerous to travel on the roads. Exactly right. The Hochein Tivot, and the ones who actually were brave enough, the ones who went on these roads, Yelchu Orachot Akal Kalot, went on broken roads, which means they weren't, it was too dangerous to keep them up, actually. They'd come under disrepair. Nobody walked on them, and a few people who walked on them found that the roads were essentially in a state of heavy disrepair. The next pasuk becomes even more significant. Chadlu Prazon B'Yisrael. There were no more a prazon, and Arei Prazi is an unwalled city, it's a suburb around the cities, which means people stopped living outside, bless you, of walled cities. They started living only behind walls, essentially. Chadlu Prazon B'Yisrael Chadeli, they became totally empty. Ad Shekamti Dvorah Shekamti in B'Yisrael, which is a beautiful poetic line, which we'll discuss in a week or two. However, there is an important next sentence which continues to describe something which I think is important to catch when it comes to Shamgar. In Pasuk Chet, in verse 8, it says, Yivchar Elohim Achadashim, they chose new gods. Az, and because of that, Lachem Sha'arim, they had war that came to their very gates. Magain im Yera'ev Varomach, a shield if it would be seen, and a spear. Now that's poetic. What you really need to do is switch around. It's Magain Viromach in Yera'eh, which means neither a shield nor a spear was seen. Barba'im Elef to Yisrael, amongst 40,000 Israelis. What that means that there would be essentially one spear and one shield per 40,000 people, because what they used to do back then, and maybe probably what they do today, is if you were a conquering country, you took away the weapons. And with that in mind, B'nei Shamgar ben Anat, Now go back to Shankara Bhananab and let's take a look and see what he's making war with. Now it's very significant. See, normally we think, oh, he's a great warrior. He slipped out his, he could have fought with a sword, but he felt like showing off and knocking everybody off with the Malmada Bakar. That's not what's going on if you tie these two parts together. Let's take a look back and it becomes very, very clear what's happening. The Malmada Bakar. You want to know why he's using Malmada Bakar? Because he didn't have anything else. That's right. What?
Yeah.
That's all he had. It paints a very different picture. You'd have to connect Devorah Shir to really see to tie it together. Once you tie it together, that one sentence really talks about a great despair of what's going on in Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't that he wanted to fight with. He had nothing else to fight with. It was that or stick. And he chose the best thing he had, which was a plowshare.
Sorry, it was actually very common, even like in the Chinese dynasties, with the criminal on swords, that the people, peasants, would take agricultural implements.
Right, pipes, and fight with pipes.
And the nunchucks and everything, with, for beating the fangs, and everything became like they took whatever agricultural tools. If that's the only thing.
Right, exactly right. And unfortunately, I'm sorry, and Anne, you want to say?
Yeah, I thought during the time of Saul and Yonatan.
It was all, yes, during the midnight period.
That it was an accomplishment for those two to have had.
Correct, yes. Yes, which is how we actually know, because there it's explicitly written that there was no weaponry. Here we have to do a little extrapolation. We have to know the Shaul and Yonatan story, that it was very impressive they actually had a sword. And we tie in that little song of Dvorah, and then we tie this little Malmada Bakar thing, and only then can you build the picture. You're right, there it's explicit, and here it's only implicit. But I think the Radak is right. It wasn't much of a Yeshua. Because obviously he wasn't strong enough to get the weapons back. He was just strong enough to push away some Plishtim. Which of course brings us to the next topic of conversation, which is the Plishtim. It's an important one to discuss because it's a commonly mistaken one. And it's used by Bible critics against us, so therefore it needs to be understood correctly within the historical reference. Plishtim were an incredibly well-armed people. Which is even more of the commentary here. Everybody knew that Plishtim had a major city arms. In fact, I think there was a beautiful picture in here of an Egyptian drawing of the Plishtim, which is shocking. These are the Plishtim people. Let me get it for you, because it's something to see. Mm-hmm. I'll bring it around to the other side. Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, here. If you please pass it around to everybody. Sorry. I always have dinner over my room, so I apologize. Well, maybe it's been deep a while.
That looks a tough one, Pesach.
What's that? You know something, thank you. Yeah, you're right.
But
this is but there's the shocker. This picture, you would think that this is Greco-Roman. This picture is correctly dated from Ramses III, which is 1200 BCE, before there was a Greek or a Roman. It dates back to essentially the Shoftim period. So how is it possible that these people are dressed up like Greeks and Romans? And that's exactly what I want to get to.
But it's interesting, the drawing, the style of the drawing is not at all Egyptian.
You know what? Let me read it carefully. But this is Ramses III. You know what it may have been inspired by? It may have been inspired by the art of the very Plishtim and where they came from, and I'll discuss where they came from in a second. If you know where they come from, they come from a place called Kafdor, which is a little island in the North Mediterranean Sea, a little bit south of Greece.
Yes.
So what? It's not Cyprus. This Kafdor is Anatolia. There's another island next to Cyprus. Cyprus is a larger island. To the west of Cyprus, I should have brought my world map. And I doubt there's one here. There's a smaller island that we call Kafdor. I do not know what the name is. I think it's considered either one of the Greek or Turkish islands. I don't even know who it belongs to now. It's close to Cyprus, which is divided down the middle. And that's essentially where the Plishtim come from. And now let me set up the time period, because when you read about the Plishtim, the tendency is to say is, first of all, the idea, of course, that the Palestinians, the Plishtim, which of course is ridiculous. We know this ridiculous. But the idea that there was a first owner of Israel, because don't forget, when Avram got to Eretz Israel, who was actually already living there? The Plishtim. The Plishtim. What's that? Part of Eretz Israel. And we'll see how much. But what I'll show you is that it's a different Plishtim. It's two different Plishtim.
From what time?
From Avram's time, and from these Plishtim are a different Plishtim than Avram's time. That's
the
punchline again.
The
these are the sea peoples, exactly right. But let me go back to Bereshit's Plishtim, and then we'll go forward to these Pushkin. And I think it's important to know this historically, which is why I said I could cut this year a little bit short, because I want to go into more or less the geopolitics of the scenario that we're dealing with. The Pushkin, of course, will become the arch enemies of Israel. There will be no greater enemy until they wind up coming head-to-head with Ashur and Babel. And therefore, it pays to understand a little bit about the Pushkin. The confusion is that in Bereshit, the Plishtim are mentioned like this. In chapter 10 of Genesis, it's in Parshat Noach, it's actually going through the descendants of the three sons who came off the boat, and it says, Knan Yalad et Sido, and we're going through the children of Knan, and he says, where is it? In Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim, which is one of the children of Ham. Am I right? Ham? I don't know. Hold on a second. Let me see. I think maybe actually a child. Let me go to the top. Maybe people don't know. Shem Ham Yafet. B'nei Yafet first. B'nei Ham. Kush, Mitzrayim, Kut, and Knan. Those are the four. So Mitzrayim is the son of Ham. Keep in mind, by the way, what's important to realize is in these descendants, there are exactly 70 nations. That's famous. We're famous for these 70 nations versus the 70 people go down to Israel. The Rabban says quite clearly that there weren't exactly 70 nations. I mean, that's, you know, unless you really get into the whole Kabbalah, that God made sure there were 70 nations, the Rabban takes a much more practical approach, which is the right one, which is they didn't mention all the kids. They mentioned the kids that were pertinent. And God wanted to create this idea of 70 nations to represent control over nature, the number 7 times 10. That is, it is Kabbalistic, what in the number 7 and 10, but you shouldn't think there were only 70 nations. I mean, that's, you know, highly unlikely. And there weren't only 70 kids, also highly unlikely. The Rabban says they mentioned the kids, that it was important to mention. The number that they wanted to get up to specifically was the 70, because it would later equate against the 70 Jews who were going down to Mitzrayim. You could buy the Ramban, you could take a much more Kabbalistic approach, that there were exactly 70 nations. But you really need not get caught up with the loudest, exactly 70 nations. There's no reason to caught up in that. And therefore, when we have things like if he was the son of somebody else, you don't necessarily know that they're a son. It could be a grandson. We have Achim, which we see in the Torah actually means cousins. Achai, Achotihu, he calls his wife Achoti, and then he explains that it really is Achoti, but it's not really his sister. It's a sister from the other side. So you have to take this with a little bit of grain of salt. Even though we have descendants, we don't know exactly. There may have been grandfathers and sons mixed in. The result that we don't know. Ubnei Ham, Kush, Mitzrayim, Lifut. And now let's go through Mitzrayim's kids. Umitzrayim yalad et Ludim, v'et Anamim, v'et Lehavim, v'et Naphtuchim, v'et Patrusim, v'et Kasluchim, asher yatsu misham plishtim, v'et Kaptur. Which means we get the Patrusim, the Kasluchim, Asher Yatzu Misham, who came out of there, Plishtim and Kaphtorim. So now we have Plishtim, which seem to be the descendants of the Mitzrayim people. And yet, we know historically that the Plishtim are in fact from the sea people. They are one and the same. There is no doubt. Archaeologically, we know this for a fact. It's on the tablets of Ramses III, who lived during the Shoshan period. So how do we figure out these Plishtim versus those Plishtim? So Rashi, of course, says something very interesting about what does it mean, Asher Yatzu Misham Plishtim, that came out of them Plishtim. So he quotes a Medrash, which tells a very off-color story about how Patrusim and Kasluchim did a little wife swapping, and therefore their kids came out, and Mitzrayim and the Plishtim were the result of that. That Medrash, just for the guess, is a shot at the Plishtim. If I had to interpret that message, I don't think that's meant to be understood. Shot is probably saying, and if you want to know who the, like your mother was the mother, your mother was a dog type of thing. So that was probably that. What's that? Yeah, you visually your mother judge. I think probably that's what Chazal was saying. Ramban knows about the Medrash, and he deviates from the Medrash, and he says like this, because not only that, the Medrash is difficult to understand, because it doesn't say Yatsumi Hem, it came from them, Yatsumi Sham, which is a place. So what is Ramban said? Ramban says something fascinating before he was in archaeology. Yatsumi Sham, V'yaldati, Ramban says, and based on what I could tell, the derech ha'pshat, using simple understanding of the text, hayu kasluchim yoshvei ir sheshmaken. Kasluchim lived in a city whose city name was Kasluchim. Vayitam mechlal eretz Kaphtor, and it was part of this greater area called Kaphtor. So he doesn't have Kaphtor in the Mediterranean island. He has this as a place in Egypt. Asher sham kafturim achayhem. Their brothers, the kafturim, lived there. V'yatzu misham min hakafturim asher heim mizera kasluchim. And they left from the kafturim, who were the descendants of the kasluchim, v'achul atur lahem rucha. And these plishtim went from that city, essentially, to find themselves a better place to live. Which was what? The nikru acharkaf plishtim, because they conquered a place called Haleshet, which is the Israel that we know. So he takes a more simple approach, that they were actually driven out of, or left, this Egyptian area. What's fascinating, by the way, is this is accurate with the sea people. But before we get there, we have something which strikes us as a conundrum. Because the first plishtim that we see in Bereshit is Avimelech. But Avimelech lives in a place called Grar, and a place called Be'er Sheva. Let me read it to you. Vayihi be'eit ani, vayomer Avimelech u'pichol sar tzva'o. The reason why I also want to mention this is a hint for next week. Because if you notice, Avimelech, we have a king, and we also have a guy named Pichol sar tzva'o. And the question that you always have is, why is the sar tzva'o coming in as a main player? Which is a question that we're going to have to ask again in Parsha Tzvorah, because the story doesn't really revolve around the king called Yavin. It actually revolves around a guy named Sisera, who is sar tzva'o. But put that in the back of your heads right now. So he comes and he makes a deal with them, and he says... What's that?
He's second to the throne, right?
I would say that the general would probably be second to the throne, just as a guess. What's interesting, though, is Yavin is almost completely forgotten in the story of Devorah. Here, Pichol doesn't really play a major role. It's mostly Avimelech versus Avram, as opposed to by us, where it's pretty much Pichol versus Devorah and Pichol versus Barak. Yavin just sort of disappears. So that's an interesting difference, which we'll deal with at a later time.
Sisera.
Thank you, Sisera. At the very end of chapter 21, it says, "By Chutu Brit with the Er Shava, they make a deal in the Er Shava. By Yakam Avimelech uPichol Sar Tzvao, and so gets up Avimelech and his general Pichol. By Ashuvu El Eretz Plishtim, but they don't live in Eretz Plishtim. We think of Eretz Plishtim as being the flatlands of where we know Gaza, but we know where Pichol comes from, where Avimelech comes from. It says so in the previous chapter. He comes to a place called Grar, which is still in the mountains, the Judean mountains. It's further south than Be'er Sheva, but it's still in the Judean mountains. But here's the really weird part. It says that Pichol and Yavin go back to Eretz Plishtim. Then it says, Vayita Eshel Be'er Sheva. Avram, of course, because now he's made this contract, he could stay in Be'er Sheva. So he plants trees there. Vayikra Sham B'Shem Adonai El Olam. He calls out the God is the God of all the world. Vayagar Avram Be'eretz Plishtim Yamin Rabin. Which means he lived in the land of the Plishtim for many, many days. Now, there is a seeming contradiction. How is it possible that that Avimelech leaves the land to go back to Eretz Plishtim, and yet the land that he's actually in, Be'er Sheva, is also called Eretz Plishtim? So the Ramban explains also in his very expertise way. He says what it means is he went back to the main city, Grar, of the Plishtim, and a suburb of the land of the Plishtim was Be'er Sheva. But what that means is that the people who came out of Kaftorim and Patrusim had not only taken Israel that we know it, which is the Eretz Palesh that we know it, which is the Aza area, Ashkelon area, etc., but they've gone as far up into Israel as Be'er Sheva, which means in Avram's time, Be'er Sheva, and possibly even a little bit further, are considered Eretz Plishtim. That's a big deal. That's much further into Eretz Israel than we tend to think.
Do we actually know that they're on the coast, or are they only in the...
No, we know that they're on the coast. How do we know that they're on the coast? Because of the name Peleshet. The name Peleshet does in fact mean a coastal invasion. That's what a Plisha means. And that's where we get the reason why they're called the Plishtim is because Leflosh means to invade by sea and to take over a piece of land. So, historically, archaeologically, they've been able to identify, archaeologists today have been able to identify two periods of a sea people conquering this area around the Aza area. One being in the time of Avram, which would date back to 1900, I always think in terms of CE, so about 1900 of the Common Era. And then we find out that there's another Plishtim. They tend to be conquered. Now, how do we know that they disappear? Because when the Jews get back to Eretz Yisrael, the land of Be'er Sheva is not owned by the Pishtim at all. It's owned by the Kanaanim. So the Kanaanim clearly have sort of taken back the land that during Abram's time had belonged to the Pishtim. They disappear. So who are these? And what's also strange is Yeshua doesn't talk about the Pishtim at all. Moshe does. It's called Derech HaPishtim. We don't want to go up, right? We're afraid to go up Derech HaPishtim. But Yeshua doesn't, during the 40 years of conquest, Yeshua doesn't reference them at all. They're not mentioned until 120 years later, right? Because we have 40 years of Otniel ben Kenaz. We got 80 years of Ehud ben Gera. So only 120 years later do the Pishtim come back. And not only that, the Pishtim are minor characters here. How do I know this? Because some guy manages to conquer them. Right, they're not minor. They manage to essentially control this territory and to remove all the weapons from the territory. But we won't see them as the major player until the very end of Sefer Shoftim, which is in Shimshon's time. Until then, Midian is the major player. Midian is the enemy of Gibeon. We've got the Ammonites, the Moabites, we've got the Canaanites. But the Pishtim? Pishtim are almost unheard of. They're local players. So how is it possible that this nation... Also, another thing that would bother you is Avimelech is very Semitic. The whole communication, the idea that he communicates with God and that he recognizes God. Even his name, Avimelech, is a Semitic name. The Plishtim that we meet later on are anything but Semitic. They're not a Semitic tribe at all. We know, maybe asemitic would be more appropriate, but yes, anti-Semitic also. So, plus the fact that archaeological proof that we know exactly where they come from, and I guess that's where I should lead up to next.
I might be a little thick about this, but you say that we're talking about two different...
Plishtim.
We're talking about two different derivations. So you're saying that in Chumash, if I'm understanding correctly, it's descendant of
Mitzrayim.
Of Mitzrayim, who's a descendant of Cush.
Right.
Right, from Noah.
Yes, the word Semitic probably wasn't appropriate, but a related people from that area.
Right. Okay. Now, the other Plishtim that we're reading about here are different. Where do they derive from?
Excellent question. So the truth is, the only thing that we know that they derive from is a place called Kafdor.
Right. It mentions that in Bereshit. What people did they derive from? Well, I know you said Kafdor, and it's understandable that they came, that they were part of the Greek.
The Kafdor
is the same name, also. Yeah, why can't you say it is the same people? That they were just went back and forth. They were pushed back. You said Kafdor is an island.
Well,
exactly. Kafdor was an island off the coast.
Derivation.
They were pushed back.
Nikubah.
And then they came
Could out. They just be the same derivation by people who traveled?
Well, the names are the same.
Well, I prefer the two invasion approach.
Yeah, in fact, I was just reading about Hawaii, and there were two different groups of Polynesians who came to the islands of Hawaii a good 100 years apart from each other.
And deriving from the same basic area, just in different ways?
Yeah.
The truth is, I don't know too much about the archaeology of the original Christian that were in Avram's time. What I do know, and I don't know whether that's because there is no archaeological data, because I just don't know it. More likely, I don't know it. What we do know for a fact, as opposed to speculation, is that the Sea Peoples came down during the time of Menhapit, who was the pharaoh immediately preceding the 20th dynasty. The 20th dynasty was Ramses III. I guess it was Ramses II and Ramses III. We know that they invaded during the time
so
of Menhapit.
From whom would they come?
I would guess Yafet. That's my
from
guess.
Yafet?
I would guess. Because we know that they came from this island of Kafdor, which is a Greek
island. And
they always
say Yafet went to Greece, right? That his descendants went to Greece?
That's correct. Now, it's hard to say, because keep in mind, 1,000 years has gone by. And because Kafdor is in the middle of the Mediterranean, it could be that as much as the Yafet's kid sailed south to Kafdor, you could also have a situation where the Mitzrim, during that 1,500-year period, when we meet them again during Abram's time, are sailing north to Kafdor. In fact, what might be even more likely is that these people, the Pishtim, who look mighty Greek, to the point where even Ramses III is drawing them, and I agree, that the drawings do not seem very Egyptian. They seem surprisingly Greco-Roman. And in fact, my guess is they might be copied from the very art which is being created by the Pishtim themselves. It could be that they were a mulatto, a mixture of going north wave of Mitzrayim and going south wave of Yafet. We don't know why they leave Kafdor, but we know we get the feeling, I think the sense is that they were something like the Puritans. They were forced off the land of Kafdor. We do know that they invaded the Hittites and wiped them out. The Hittites essentially disappear by the Plishtim. The Plishtim will take out all of northern, southern Syria and northern coastline of Syria and very northern Lebanon. They will also invade into the Lebanon area with less success against the Sidonese. And they will invade Menhafetz area, which is approximately 1,250 before the time of era. Ramses III, and this is where you have this tablet is actually taken. Menhafetz is a I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, by the way. No guarantee on that. Ramses is easier to pronounce, so I know I'm getting that right. This is actually from the tablets of Ramses III, which describes the war and his incredible victory over the Plishtim. He describes them as sea people who came down and invaded his land. It appears from his literature, of course, they won the war hands down. It's like if you go to Egypt today and you look up the history of the 1973 war, it was a gargantuan Egyptian victory. So, of course, whoever's still around writes the history books. Modern historians, taking various different histories from different documentation, believe that it was a little inconclusive. What they believe is that the Plishtim were driven north, that the Plishtim landed on Egyptian territory. The Mitzrayim won, but won just enough to force them into their arch-enemy Israel to the north. So they forced them up the coastline, up the Mediterranean coastline, where they then took over, perhaps from the weaker Plishtim that had come before, into the area that we know of today as being Gaza and Ashkelon and Ashdod, etc., etc. And that's where they start to make trouble for Israel. The reason why they're essentially even worse than the previous Plishtim is because they bring a great deal of weaponry. How does it all tie in with the Minoan peoples? The Minoan were a race that was wiped out by, was a rather advanced race that was wiped out by, what? I think it was by a volcano. I think a volcano wiped out, a massive explosion wiped out the Minoans. They worshipped a bull god, which is where some Bible critics say we got our Abel from, which is highly doubtful, but that's, you know, they figure, oh, I got a bull here, I got a bull there, it must be the same thing. But that's the usual kind of biblical criticism. It's right, right. It tends to be rather shallow. You know, I put A and B together and I get D. You know, it's a very strange thing. But apparently the Minoans, we know archaeologically, were an advanced people. They had more plumbing, they had multiple level buildings, they were like they were comparable to the Anasazi of the American peoples that lived down in California. They were much more advanced than the typical indigenous people. I know sometimes when you hear stories about the Minoans and the people who like to make religions out of these things, so they have the Minoans communicating, you know, via walkie-talkies and stuff. That's a little bit ridiculous. But they were more advanced than the general peoples. Based on the swords, just based on the swords and the scabbards, it appears clear that they were heavily into the Iron Age before Israel was. What's that? Were the Hittites the ones who invented the Iron Age? I don't know.
And then they
possible.
Sold their weapons to Plishtim, who ended up killing them.
Or maybe the Plishtim just conquered them for their stuff. Yeah, I don't know. What's interesting is that the very sword work, if you remember from the previous picture, the typical sword during that time looked like this. It was a single-edged bronze sword. That was during the time of the Shofim. These are the swords that the Plishtim is carrying. So as you can see, you can just take a look at the weaponry and figure that Israel's in for a tough time.
So you're saying that it's possible that both sets of Plishtim you're describing actually derive from the same parentage, except that one group left town, so to speak, and emigrated to the island that's up shore.
So it seems.
It could be. It could be that way rather than they come from two different ends of sons of Noah's family.
The only problem that we have there, then, is this passage. V'eta patrusim v'eta kasachim asher yitzu misham, who left them there, Plishtim v'et Kaphtorim, which seems to put the Plishtim and the Kaphtorim as two separate peoples that are both coming out of the Mitzri people. This would appear. So it seems. It seems like they were driven out of Egypt.
About 1,000 years.
It seems that they were driven out of Egypt or left Egypt to go to Kaphtor. My guess is, based on the technology that we're looking at, they probably took stuff down from the Hittites, perhaps, if what you're saying is correct. I actually don't know, probably it's right. Were from the beginning of the descendants of the very early Greco period.
Well, once
they
went
back,
they
absorbed
the culture
that was going on.
Yeah, so that's possible. Then they came back. They had different weapons and weaponry, and they had different ideas, perhaps, from all those years away. But the derivation is really the same as what you described.
Right. So what we're referring to here, and again, I'm speculating. I'm a little out of my league. Is we're speculating racially Middle Eastern. and culturally, the second wave of visual would be
right.
culturally more early Greco.
Right. Right.
There's something else interesting which we haven't met about the Christian we won't get to until we get to Shimshon, which is when Shimshon, remember the, not Shimshon's time actually, but during Shmuel's time, if you remember, the Aron goes to, gets captured, and it winds up taking apart one of their gods, which is called Dagon, which is generally understood, although we have no archaeological remnant of Dagon. We just don't, we have not found a god named Dagon, but the general consensus is that the word Dag is the important word, and therefore it would be a fish god, half man, half fish.
Dagon.
It's also...
That's the way Cecil B. DeMille did it.
Oh, did he really? He did this in showing that it was a fish god? It it goes back even to Rashi mentions as much. Probably it was from a Dagon, which brings ideas of Poseidon, which brings ideas of mermaids and other things which would really affect early Greek literature. So the idea that they came out of this island and that they were racially one but culturally another is also no surprise. I'm not an archaeologist, so I hope I haven't left you with a strange case with Pishtim, but I did want to make a distinction that the first Pishtim are significantly different than the second Pishtim. The first Pishtim do not seem to have the technology of the second Pishtim. They seem to just come out of that Egyptian basin. The second Pishtim are a different, scary, and nasty people. We know exactly when they hit the shores because Ramses writes about it. It was exactly 1190, which puts us exactly in the latter years of Ahab and Nero. We know this exactly, because we can count back from the destruction of the temple. 470 years, plus 70, plus 420 years of the first temple, plus 440 years, taking back to Yeshua, it puts us exactly into Ahab and Nero's time. So the dates match up perfectly, that when we start to see the Christian is exactly when Ramses pushes them north.
The Nehemiah Loewe quotes to Yaakov as saying that... when Shamgar was in power, Ehud was still alive the last few years, but perhaps he was just weaker or too old to do the fighting. So he couldn't be the so-called leader, but Ehud still exerted some spiritual influence on the people during that time, but that Shamgar became judge while Ehud was still alive, and that may be because he was old. That's what they said.
Yep.
And the reason that Kliyakor says that's proven is that Ehud is mentioned in the following chapter.
Right, the Ehud died.
That Ehud died is mentioned in the following chapter, so he concludes Ehud was really alive at that time, although
right.
he wasn't in power.
Now, according to that Kliyakor, the word V'acharav, and after Ehud, which I'm garbing or not, you'd have to understand the word Acharav not literally, because if you do, it has to be after Ehud.
It wasn't
you have to understand.
He was the judge afterwards.
Judge after Ehud.
What? He could be incapacitated. He's older now.
Okay, I'll buy that.
He can't be judged till you're 100.
Especially
that the judge was the chief warrior, the chief general, so he wasn't able to be
over.
The chief general.
And we really see a weakness. I would prefer Radak's idea that he actually matches up, he doesn't overlap with Ehud, he actually overlaps with Devorah, because that seems to be correct in Devorah's song. I'm not saying that Kliyakor is wrong. Whichever way you put him, at the end of Ehud's life or the beginning of Dora's life, he's for sure a weak leader without a real success at taking over. And one of the most salient points is we see that Ehud is essentially a national leader. And so certainly was Otniel ben Kenaz. And Devorah will also become something of a national leader. Shamgar ben Anat fights the Pishtim. We never even find out what tribe Shamgar ben Anat is from. We put him, obviously, either at Yehuda to the south, or possibly even Shimon that was absorbed into Yehuda. But he is so localized.
That's 600 back.
What's that?
That's
600. That's right. Compared to everybody else.
God,
everything about Shamgar ben Anat is not
his name. But he's not natural.
So we see there's a lack of nationalization, there's a real localization, there's a real weakness, the fact that he has no weaponry, he has that ability to get weaponry together. All of this speaks about an incredibly weak leader, which begs for somebody like, Dvorah says it herself, Achah Kamti Dvorah, Kamti in B'Yisrael, which of course is, it almost sounds egotistical, but the truth is it's very beautiful, until a mother came up and stood up for Israel. And as I mentioned, the mothers played a key figure at the end of Shoftim, both with our bad mother of Nechayahu and the good mother of Hannah. I'd like to make sure to end in 5 minutes, just to make sure people get down to the blood thing. But I do want to start. I do want to feel like we started Devorah. So I'd like to mention one very important point here. In the beginning of chapter 4, I will read the first few verses. I'll make a quick point in chapter 4, and that means next week we will be never definitely. Oh, and I'll ask about that in a second. What do we do next week? Vayosifim bnei Yisrael asot ha'ra b'nei Hashem ve'eyud meitz. Vayimkreim Adonai b'yad Yavin melech Kanaan, and God sold them into the hands of Yavin, the king of Kanaan, asher malach b'chatzor, who ruled in Chatzor. V'sar tzva'o Sisra, and he had a general whose name was Sisra, v'hu yoshev, and he lived in Charosh Ragoyim, in a place called the orchards of Goyim. Vayitzaku bnei Yisrael Adonai, and they cried out to God, ki tshamiot recha barzelo, because he had 900 chariots. V'hu lachatz bnei Yisrael, and he pressured Israel, the Choska Esrim Shana. These 20 years, maybe at the end of Ehud's life, they may be at the beginning of Devorah's period, hard to say. In fact, this whole thing is difficult to say starting from the very beginning. The first problem that we have is, who's the name of the king? His name is Yavin, the king of Kanaan, who ruled in Chatzor. The first problem for people who are familiar, if you're familiar with Sefer Yoshua, and I brought it here in 2nd Sheet if you're curious, is Yavin Melech Chatzor is dead. He's deader than a doornail. Yoshua fights against Chatzor. Now as he fights against Chatzor, he razes the entire city, burns it to the ground, like Yericho and Ai. Very few cities were razed. When the city was razed, it meant nobody was going to live there. It was kept as a destroyed city. And it says specifically that Chatzor was a major player, and Yavin was the player, he was the king of Chatzor. Chatzor was the head of all the kingdoms. The Ed Chatzor Sarach Be'esh, it says in Yoshua, Zulatir Chatzor Levadah Sarach Yoshua. Yoshua was not able to conquer all the cities, but Chatzor he raised to the ground because it was the central city. Chatzor, if you're familiar with the land of Israel, is above the Yam Kinneret. It is not where the battle takes place. The battle of Devorah takes place in Eretz Yisrael. And if you have this map, it's a really nice map, because you can feel the palm. You can feel the mountains right next to Yam Kinneret, to the top. You can feel the mountains to the south, and you can see Eretz Yisrael. Do you see Eretz Yisrael? And right through it, you can see the river that runs through. You see Har Tabor? You see that big round mountain, Har Tabor? It's, if you drive through Israel, it's on the larger map. In order to see Har Tabor, go to the bottom of Yam Kinneret, and then go about 20 kilometers due west, and 5 kilometers down, and you'll see a little round mountain called Har Tabor. Does everybody see it? So the north is Vulun. Look at Chatzor. Chatzor, oh, it's not on this map.
It is.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. So you go north of Yam Kinneret all the way up into the mountains. Chatzor is in fact in mountains. We know exactly what Chatzor is. It's a city today. I remember I actually spent a few Shabbatot on Chatzor. You're going to look essentially.
I thought Chatzor was on the other side of the mountain.
There's actually there's two Chatzor. There's Chatzor. That's right. There's Chatzor Gilith and there's Chatzor HaJomit, I think it's called. Chatzor Gilit's on the other side, but our Chatzor is Chatzor Jomit, which is on the west side of the Jordan. And by the way, it's much lower. In fact, during the time when the Golan Heights were owned by Syria, they used to sit there where Chatzor HaGilit is now, and they used to shell down. I mean, it was a free-for-all. They used to just lob shells directly down into Chatzor HaJomit. It was a very dangerous place to live. So all of a sudden, we got weird things going on, because the battle doesn't take any place near Chatzor. Chatzor is razed. Yavin is dead, and has been dead for 100 years.
We know there's two Chatzor's name with two
Yavin
appears
to be like Avinoah.
That's right.
Generic term.
Oh, well, that's exactly it. But what do you do with the word Asher Malach B'Chatzor? So there you have to pay close attention to tense. Take a look at what's going on. Vayimkrein B'Yad Yavin Melech Kanaan, the king of Kanaan, Asher Malach B'Chatzor. You hear that? Who ruled in Chatzor. What it means is his name is Yavin Melech Kanaan Asher Malach B'Chatzor. That's his name. That's his title. He's the king of Kanaan, like the guy who used to rule in Chatzor. Because we know that Chatzor was head of all the... You hear what I'm saying? I'm trying to think of an English phrase that's like that. What's that? Right, Hayavim Yavim. So essentially, and by the way, there are Bible critics. I apologize. I'll finish up in just a minute. I apologize. But it's important to keep that also. Essentially, what it's saying is that his title was Yavin Melech Chatzor, Asher Malach Hashem Chatzor, a very long title. Why? Because they were trying to, the Canaanites who lived only in this valley, Israel, were trying to recreate their former glory during Yeshua's time, when they owned not only the valley, but all of the Galil Elyon and the Galil Tachton. So they called themselves. Where did they actually rule? So here's the confusion. The Bible, by the way, Bible critics put this Devorah story before Yehoshua. That's what they did. Which is just ridiculous. And all you have to do is read the text to know that it just... All you have to do is look at the past tense, Asher Malach B'Chatzor, and you know that it doesn't mean he's ruling in Chatzor. It means they ruled in Chatzor, and you understand that it's a title. But Bible critics are Bible critics, what do you do? V'sartzo Sisra, and his general Sisra, the who Yosei B'Charosh L'Goyim. The problem there is who? So, again, here the critics want to say the Avin lived up in Chatzor, and Sisra lived down in Charosh HaGoyim. Where is Charosh HaGoyim? You know where it is. It's on the Mediterranean coast. It's down by Akko. So if you go down this valley, if you see the Eimek Yisrael, you go all the way down to close to Haifa, not Akko, to the Haifa area.
Oh, okay.
Then essentially you get Charosh HaGoyim. Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael on the night Shalmei Rechav Barzelo, v'hu l'chatzit b'nei Yisrael b'chos kasrim shah. And he pressured Israel for 20 years. I believe the reason why it's making it very vague, because the power player here, as we'll see in the upcoming story, is not Yavin. Yavin appears to be a figurehead, and we have an example of that. If you remember, Shaul had a son named Ish-Boshet. Ish-Boshet was a very weak fellow. Who actually ruled? Sar-Tzva Avner Ben-Ner actually ruled. So here too we have a situation where Yavin is a figurehead. What's important to realize when you first read this is don't get confused by that word Chatzor. The battles did not take place in Chatzor. The Canaanites had not conquered Chatzor. That was well in Israeli territory. His title was Yavin Melech Canaan Hashem Alakha Chatzor. And that's a title. And if you understand that, then you remove some of the doubt that the biblical critics have put in. And again, this is a historical fact as opposed to a content fact.